From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Critics dubbed it the War on Coal when President Obama recently released his plan to tackle climate change. The president's approach includes several elements, such as money to boost so-called green energy and to help communities deal with the impacts of a warming planet. But Mr. Obama's plan centers on the nation's utilities, aiming to cut their carbon emissions by 17% over the next 7 years. And since coal-fired power plants usually emit the most carbon, the impact on them is getting the most attention. Despite coal's dirty reputation, the U.S. still uses and produces lots of it. Here in New Hampshire, it's an important, although shrinking, piece of our energy picture, providing about 13% of our overall electricity supply last year. So in the Granite State, reaction to the president's plan was mixed. Some predicted these carbon restrictions might be so tight that the state's two coal plants would have to shut down, causing instability in the energy supply, along with huge price hikes. But others took the complete opposite view, that the long-term effects of inaction on climate change are so devastating, they well outweigh any short-term cost. Today in The Exchange, coal and climate change, what the president proposes and New Hampshire's response. And let's hear from you, too. Let's get your thoughts in. 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us a short email, the address exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests for the hour. Joining us from Boston is Kurt Spalding, administrator for the EPA's New England region. And Kurt Spalding, great to have you. Thanks for your time.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
With us in studio, Martin Murray, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire, the state's largest utility. And Martin, welcome back and good to have you.
Good morning.
And also with us, Tom Irwin, vice president and director of Conservation Law Foundation New Hampshire. And Tom, welcome back to you and thanks for being here.
Glad to be here.
Well, and Tom, I want to start with you, but obviously hear from everybody. The president's plan, as I said, aims to cut carbon from power plants by 17% from 2005 levels. How big a deal is this, Tom?
It's a big deal. You know, climate change obviously is the greatest environmental challenge of our time. It's an issue that's touching the lives of people here across the country and across the globe. And, you know, we're really seeing in recent years evidence of a scale of climate change and a pace of climate change that is happening even more rapidly than was predicted by models years ago. So the clock is ticking. This is a critical issue, and we certainly welcome the federal government, the Obama administration, weighing in, developing this plan, and launching it. It's much needed. And
is it bold enough for your taste?
Well, it does more than just address power plants.
Right.
It does position the United States to be a leader on the issue of climate change, and I think we have been criticized rightly internationally for not showing leadership on this issue. So we certainly give credit to the president for stepping up in this way to position the United States to be a leader on this issue, because we can't solve this alone. And to have standing in the world and ask others, especially developing countries, to step forward and take this issue seriously, we need to lead by example.
Well, and Martin, to you, and Tom's absolutely right. You know, there are other elements to this plan, a few of which I mentioned in the introduction. But just focusing on the power plant emissions, since you are with Public Service of New Hampshire, what does this mean for the state and for your company specifically?
Well, what's interesting, Laura, here in New Hampshire and New England is we're very different than the rest of the country. So when President Obama and people in general talk about, as you mentioned, kind of the war on coal, well, in New England, coal is not the single big target that it once was. I think Kurt and Tom will agree with me. The math shows us that last year, 88% of the CO2 released by power plants came from gas plants, not coal plants.
That's because coal is really shrinking in
exactly.
terms of – it wasn't that big a contributor to the energy supply.
Exactly.
So it wasn't that big a contributor in terms of carbon.
Exactly. And that is a result of the marketplace. It's a result of our regional greenhouse gas initiative, for example. So if one is looking at, well, what are the sources of carbon that we have to address here in New England, it may not be coal. And in fact, I think – and I'm sure we'll talk more about this during the hour in terms of how different we are here in New England – but I think in large measure, a lot of people around the country might look to this region as kind of a model for the rest of the country.
So are we barking up the wrong tree here, picking on coal?
Well, in New England, it's not a simple black and white yes or no. I mean, we're taking steps here in New Hampshire and New England. For example, a coal boiler a couple of years ago in Portsmouth was permanently replaced. We took it out of service, and we're burning clean wood chips. So there are things that are happening here. But if you're looking at what do we have to do in New England to reduce carbon, I think people are going to look at gas and how much we rely on it. And they're probably going to look, Laura, at transport. You know, we probably – most of us – I don't know if you took your bike or drove today. I drove. I didn't drive an electric car today. I drove a gas car. You know, we're all contributing to the CO2 emissions in the region.
Yeah, and so, of course, we've got Kurt Spaulding with us, administrator for Region 1. That's EPA's New England region. And, Kurt, you'll be in charge of implementing this thing if it comes to pass. Overall, what do you think this means for New Hampshire and New England?
Well, yes, I am in charge, or this office in EPA is in charge. And it should extend beyond my time, actually, as this administrator. Hopefully, we're setting the architecture of a long-term program to reduce CO2 emissions across the country. So this program that will occur, there's no if to it. The president made it very clear that EPA will move forward, and we'll move forward as urgently as we can, given what Tom talked about, the worsening situation and clearly the worsening problems with climate change, sea level rise, heavy rainfall events, extreme heat. We haven't had extreme drought here, but the bottom line is we need to move, and we need to move quickly in putting this program in place and getting this architecture of how we can reduce CO2 emissions across the country in place.
Why the focus, Kurt, on power plants? As Martin Murray pointed out, you know, a lot of emissions come from everybody driving to work.
Well, power plants are what we regulate under the Clean Air Act. We do regulate tailpipe emissions. There's lots of different things we regulate. But 40% of the emissions from, carbon emissions in the country do come from the electrical generating units, as we call them, EGUs. So there is a focus on power plants. But dealing with the new old power plants is a very different matter than dealing with the new ones coming online.
Sure.
And so what we want to set up is a program that is commonsensical and flexible. Some of what was talked about regarding New England and its approach is indeed part of what might be the vision across the country for how you do this flexibility.
And we're looking at all power plants, Kurt, right? Well, why all the focus on coal? Why are some people calling this a war on coal?
Well, I don't know why people are calling it a war on coal, because it's not set up to be a war on coal or a war on anything. It's set up to be a common sense program working with states, especially, on how they could reduce their CO2 emissions. You know, New Hampshire, in fact, already has a program and goals, both tied to the New England governors and the Eastern Canadian premiers and New Hampshire individually. Under Governor Lynch put forth some goals. So New England states have been thinking about how to reduce their carbon emissions for nearly a decade now, over a decade. And indeed, what we're going to be trying to do is look at some of the tools that New England's put in place, probably formalize the program to some degree under the Clean Air Act, and then move it forward. It needs to get stronger and accelerate as we go forward. But it really isn't a war on anything. In fact, what we hope, and this is my expectation, is what New England will show is that there isn't this big economic trade-off in any way or form. In fact, new prosperity can be built. I mean, when we think about New England and what it meant to get to the Industrial Revolution, I believe New England can pace the country in getting to the low-carbon revolution that needs to happen across the globe.
Our phone number for you to join us here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Today in the exchange, we're looking at President Obama's recent plan for climate change, especially the centerpiece of this plan, imposing limits on carbon emissions from power plants. We're looking at the impact on New England and New Hampshire. Let's hear from you, 1-800-892-6477. Your questions or comments about what this approach might mean for our state and our region. 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. And Martin Murray with PSNH, just picking up on what Administrator Spaulding said there about economic trade-offs. From your perspective, Martin, what are you folks at Public Service looking at in terms of the economic trade-offs of limiting carbon emissions from power plants?
Well, one thing that I think is interesting that you might have seen on your way to work, Laura, is the fact that Merrimack Station in nearby Bow is operating today. It was operating over the weekend. It was operating last
week. That's the big
coal-fired
power plant.
We have two coal-fired power plants. One actually burns wood as well. We have one gas and oil, and we have nine hydros. But Merrimack Station is the largest single plant, and it burns coal only. It's been operating for the last, you know, week and a half or so, and that's purely a product of the demand for electricity, and that demand is because of the heat and the humidity. But what happens, Laura, is it's operating because it basically tells the operator, I can produce electricity for this price, and the cheaper, the less expensive power plants begin to fill the pool, but at some point, it's like, now we're in it. So what we're seeing is it's still economic. Something more expensive would have to be running if Merrimack Station wasn't. Our plants have, over time, over the last 10 years, saved our customers $700 million because they were operating at less than what the market price was. So it was more economic for our customers to get power from Merrimack Station and the rest of the fleet than it was purchasing from the marketplace. Now, the market is going up and down. It's going crazy because of the gas, but now there's worry about, are we depending too much on gas? So there's a lot of questions.
And Tom, I want to ask you about that too, but real quickly, Martin, in the papers the last couple of weeks, the big question is, will that Bow power plant have to shut down if this goes through?
Oh, no, I don't think so at all. We meet all state and federal regulations now. We believe, as I think Kurt mentioned, New England can pace the country in terms of demonstrating how we can reduce carbon but have a good, diverse portfolio of power. And that's the key right now is we need diversity. There's a danger in depending on just one single commodity or fuel.
All right. We will talk more after a short break. Tom Irwin, I'll give you a chance to jump in there as well. The phone number for you to join us, 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 919. Good morning. NHPR is offering you a reprieve from summer gas prices. It's the early bird prize of our summer car raffle, $2,000 in gas gift cards donated by Irving Oil that could last you up to a year. Tickets are $50 each or three for $100, and you can pick yours up at 1-888-805-6477 or nhpr.org. Mostly sunny, hot today, highs upper 80s to mid-90s across the state. We have a heat advisory in effect for most of the state this afternoon. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from Dick Thaxton Realtor, helping customers throughout the process of selling and buying homes in New Hampshire, Massachusetts, and Vermont for over two decades, on the web at dickthaxton.com. Mount Washington Cog Railway welcoming visitors for over 100 years to ride to the top of New England for dramatic, breathtaking views. Tickets at thecog.com. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, President Obama's recently released plan to tackle climate change and how it might affect New Hampshire, especially our power plants. We invite you to join us, 1-800-892-6477. Send a short email to exchange@nhpr.org or post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Our guests are Kurt Spaulding, joining us from Boston. He's administrator for the EPA's New England region. region. Also with us in studio, Martin Murray, spokesman for Public Service of New Hampshire, the state's largest utility, and Tom Irwin, vice president and director of the Conservation Law Foundation, New Hampshire. And Tom, just for the break, I promised you would get a chance also to jump in on this point that Kurt brought up and Martin brought up, the economic trade-offs of this plan.
Well, I think, first of all, coal in New England as a source of carbon has been on a downward trajectory. To be clear, that is because our coal plants are not running as much. And our coal plants aren't running as much because they are not nearly as efficient as natural gas.
That's the big switch we've seen here in New England in recent years.
And to be clear, cleaner natural gas. So our footprint across the region is trending in the right direction. But that said, even though PSNH's two coal-fired power plants in New Hampshire, Merrimack Station and Schiller, are running very little of the time, they still collectively constitute New Hampshire's single largest source of greenhouse gas emissions. So if we're going to get serious about reducing carbon emissions in New Hampshire, we have to address the issue of coal. But the important point really is, before you even get to the regulations that EPA will be promulgating to control carbon,
to make plants reduce their emissions.
Right. PSNH has very significant problems with these plants, and the problems stem from the inefficiencies of coal and of these plants. Ratepayers, PSNH ratepayers have among the highest rates in New England. And as a result, and this stems from the inefficiencies of these plants, PSNH customers have been leaving PSNH in droves. So we have an ever-dwindling base of ratepayers saddled with these increasing costs associated with polluting, inefficient coal-fired power plants.
Well, will those costs go up, Tom, though, if the president's plan goes forward? You know, will the new requirements make it even more expensive to produce power here in New England?
Probably not. Probably not. But again, before you even get to those regulations, there are significant issues that need to be addressed with these plants. And the PUC, the Public Utilities Commission staff, just last month issued a report with some very strong recommendations saying that it is no longer sustainable for PSNH to own and operate these plants because of these high rates and the ever increasing number of customers leaving PSNH.
I know you want to jump in, Martin. I don't want to forget about Kurt, too, though. So go ahead, Martin, and then Kurt Spaulding, I have another question for you.
Sure, I know you want to go to Kurt's, Kurt. So, Jarrett, very quickly, a couple of things that Tom got wrong. Actually, collectively, the gas plants in New Hampshire for the last couple of years collectively produce more CO2 than the coal plants in New Hampshire.
Because they're the ones that are up and running, right?
Also, the transition is interesting. This conversation reminds me of the fact that 10 years ago, Tom's group was the cheerleader for a new gas plant in Londonderry, AES, and they were the cheerleaders for that. Just 2 weeks ago, Tom's group was testifying in Vermont against the creation of a pipeline to carry natural gas to produce electricity in Vermont because they believe that there's too much pollution linked to gas pipelines. But the people in Vermont want that cleaner gas. They want the electricity produced at a cheaper price than they can get elsewhere. So there are transitions. There are ups and downs. We see our portfolio of diverse power plants as a continued insurance policy, a transition to a cleaner energy future. We can transition to a cleaner future, but we can't do it overnight.
I want to get you into this too, Kurt Spaulding. So, okay, transitioning to a cleaner energy future. People talk about renewable energy replacing dirtier energy sources like coal. But as you know, Kurt, alternative energy has had some tough sledding here in New Hampshire. Wind projects have run into trouble. Biomass has been controversial. PSNH's big hydro proposal has run into huge amounts of trouble. So are you confident that green energy sources really could replace dirtier sources of energy like coal?
Well, I'd like to start first with efficiency. So there was a scenario laid out, you know, hot day, coal plants are now running. They now run as peaking units. It's been discussed that the gas plants have now become our base units. So how do we avoid peaks? Well, if everyone in New Hampshire had a smart meter in their home today, the utility could, in fact, look at those homes and work with people on, as to whether they could raise the temperature on their air conditioning a couple of degrees while everyone's at work, and probably shave the energy use during peaking time so those coal plants maybe wouldn't need to run at all. So this kind of flexible approach where we look at smart meters and different ways to reduce our peaks can smooth the system and in fact, reduce greenhouse gas emissions across the board. Because a lot of what happens in New England is a very up and down curve. We use a lot of energy on days like today. Indeed, just about every plant that can run is probably running today right now. But how many air conditioners in homes are not turned down while people have gone to work? Probably a lot. So could we build a system that reduces essentially emissions from existing facilities just by being smarter about how we use energy? Renewables are certainly part of the program going forward, but I need to, in the short term, we need to think about how we can get these efficiency measures in and actually see these reductions in peaks so that the utilities can smooth out the demand. And that creates a much more efficient and resilient system, which again reduces CO2 emissions. These are the kinds of opportunities this program that the president has proposed will set up, where we can actually formalize how these are working and bring them forward. Vermont has smart meters, California has smart meters. Smart meters across New England would change the profile completely, and we could see our significant reduction going
forward.
You
could do a whole show, Laura, on people who don't trust smart meters. That's the frustrating thing, is there are a lot of people that they won't allow a smart meter attached to their home. That's interesting. I don't think Kurt would be in that club, nor would I, but there is the reality of people just don't trust them.
But the broader point on efficiency is well taken.
Sure, and we spend millions and millions and millions of dollars a year on efficiency, and it does give us something, but it doesn't give us everything.
Yeah. Tom, go ahead, jump in.
I need to comment on that just briefly, because I just visited Burlington, where they put smart meters throughout the city. Yes, 3 to 5%, maybe less, objected to having smart meters put in their homes. Let's not react to perhaps the volume of the small number of people who object to smart meters, because right now Burlington looks like they've got over 90% participation in the program. So we need to remember that sometimes these issues get loud with a relative few, when the majority, much more than the majority, is certainly willing to see their energy bills reduced and the efficiency raised in their homes.
Okay, go ahead, Tom, and then to our listeners.
That's a great point. I would just echo that energy efficiency really should be our first priority energy resource. There are a lot of gains still to be made on the energy efficiency front, which can avoid and dramatically cut down those peak hour demands. And, you know, fortunately, that is an important component of the Obama administration's plan. Here in New Hampshire, there's been some progress made on the energy efficiency front, but there is a recognition that New Hampshire is falling behind some of our neighboring states and that we could be doing more, such as by adopting an energy efficiency resource standard that sets a goal that's measurable and allows us to achieve greater energy efficiency gains over time.
All right. Well, I have a lot more questions for all of you, but let me also invite our listeners to join our conversation. The number here in the exchange again for you to take part is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. As we dive into President Obama's recently announced plan to reduce carbon emissions to tackle climate change, how do you think this could affect New Hampshire? Do you think it's heading in the right direction, especially again with this focus on reducing carbon emissions from power plants? Do you have any major concerns with this approach? Again, the number for you to join us with your comments, questions, thoughts, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, 1-800-892-6477. Here's an email that just came in from Earl in Newfane, Vermont. He says, regulating coal emissions is a great start in limiting CO2, but replacing it with gas is not the answer, as President Obama believes. Earl says, although gas is cleaner burning, the savings in greenhouse gas emissions is offset by the release of methane and the use of thousands of trucks in the transportation and drilling process. Earl, thanks for the point. And Kurt Spalding, I'll ask you what you think.
Well, I think the president has made it pretty clear. I think the Department of Energy and everyone who's looked at this issue has come to the conclusion that we need gas as certainly a transition to where we need to go in terms of a low-carbon economy. there are numbers of issues with every source of energy, whether it's hydro or whether it's gas or whether it's coal. We can discuss all the trade-offs pretty much and exhaust ourselves. The bottom line, though, is when you burn a gas, one BTU of energy generated by gas, it's much cleaner than other fossil choices. And, you know, we need to be realistic. We're not going to have enough renewable in the time frame necessary to make the transition we're talking about. I think Tom was very clear in the beginning. You know, this climate change problem is worsening at a much faster pace than I think any of us thought 10, 20 years ago. So we need to move. We need to move quickly. We need to move in a common sense way, and I think gas is part of that common sense future for how we're going to produce energy for the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 decades. After that, I think there's all kinds of opportunities with new technology and super efficiencies. But right now, I think getting us through the next couple of decades, gas has to be a part of that equation.
Well, here's something I've heard, and I want to ask you, Kurt, what you think about it. Okay, I've heard a lot of people say gas as a transition fuel to where we need to go with cleaner, greener, and so forth. Does the ready supply of gas give us a disincentive to move toward that greener future?
Well, there's been a lot of discussion about the price of gas and the amount of gas and the volume of gas. I recall years ago when a lot of gas plants were built, everyone thought there'd be plentiful gas, and then gas prices were high. There's going to be a worldwide demand for gas. I think anyone who tries to tell you what gas will cost and how it affects the energy markets will be just pretending. And no one is really able to predict these things very accurately. The bottom line is we know gas is the cleanest fossil fuel available, and it's there to be used. We do need to think about supply into New England. It's not that easy to get it here in large quantities. These are tough choices that are out there, but the administration's made it very clear. We think gas is part of the solution for the next couple of decades. And it is right now the most affordable fossil fuel. Whether it stays that way, we shall see.
Tom, real quick, and then to our listeners.
Just very quickly, you know, you raised a really good point, Laura, about the potential for natural gas to be so cheap and plentiful that it gets in the way of energy efficiency, conservation. That is a real concern, and I think we do need to be careful about natural gas in New England. It clearly has a role. We'd like to see it play a niche role as a firming power for renewables, for wind, solar.
Like a backup? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, because wind is intermittent, for example. But the bottom line is we need to be sure not to overbuild infrastructure and overcommit to natural gas in a way that ties our hands in the future.
Let's get our listeners involved again. The number here on the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. Earl, thanks for that email. You can post a comment on our Facebook page, too, if you'd like. And to our callers now in Hillsborough, Wade has been waiting. Hi, Wade. Thanks for hanging on. You're on the air.
Well, thanks for taking my call, Laura.
Sure.
One point that I haven't heard in these discussions is the business model. And I think that's a sort of a 90% of the iceberg that nobody talks about, but which is driving the whole discussion. When New Hampshire and the rest of the country was first electrified over a century ago, electrification started, the only model that made sense was having a huge plant which sent out electric power to a very large area. And it's what in economics is called a natural monopoly. And that was the only way that you could get an area electrified over a century ago. But the times have changed, and now if Laura and her family want to put solar panels on the roof, you can become an electric supplier, and you can have thousands of little electric suppliers feeding into a small group, and monopolies do not like to give up their monopoly status.
You know, this is really interesting, Wade, and I've heard more and more people over the years talk about this, and I'd love to hear from you first, I think, Martin Murray, on this, the idea that maybe we should be looking less at macro energy supply and more micro energy supply.
Yeah, I think we may get there someday, Laura, but I know a family in Concord that put a lot of solar panels on the roof. They paid capital expense of more than $20,000. You and I, in our electric bill, gave them a rebate. It was actually like a $26,000, $28,000 project. They got a $6,000 rebate from the state that you and I paid for. So they put in $20,000. You and I paid for the rebate. My bill hasn't gone down. The regional bill, as far as I know, hasn't gone down. But this family now has perhaps over 20 or 25 years, they may actually net out with some savings. But it's difficult. That's just a snapshot showing it's not that easy for everyone to have their own distributed generation. I think we may get there someday, but we have to deal with the reality. Kurt mentioned, I think Tom mentioned, the peak demand. Peak demand is growing each year. We have to find a way to provide electricity when we all need it.
Or conserve, as Kurt Spalding said, so that
that's part of it.
That demand sucks less out of the system,
absolutely,
if I could put it that way. Yeah, Kurt Spalding, your thoughts, too, on Wade's business model comment.
Well, I think New England, again, I talked about New England pacing the country. In Massachusetts, solar has exploded, frankly. They've far exceeded the installation of solar they thought was possible with their aggressive programs to move it forward. I know Rhode Island's passed the law now to, again, incent the installation of solar. I want to add a point to that I think is important. Distributed generation creates a sense of resilience across the system. We have seen these another effect of climate change are these extreme storm events. Indeed, if we have some distributed generation, there's a more resilient system. Now, I don't want to underplay the challenge of that for utilities and the switching, the computers, and all the things that need to be figured out to put these kinds of systems in place. But when we transition our grid, modernize something that was actually designed, I think the caller was right. I mean, our basic model for providing energy is a century old or longer. You know, it's time to bring it to the 21st century. Look at these new technologies. The price of solar right now is dropping like a stone. I think the sense is that it will cross the cost of natural gas within 10 years. So the economics that were just discussed are going to change. So we better figure this out, because indeed when we have inexpensive solar, we'll have a much different economic model. And I think the caller's point, think about the economics of all of this, it has to be reinforced.
Go ahead, Tom.
And I would just add that, you know, market structure is very important. So, you know, in the last decade or so, we've opened the energy sector to competition. So we now have competitive electricity suppliers who are going out, obtaining energy, selling energy at competitive lower rates. And, you know, typically the cleaner energy, the lower emitting carbon dioxide energy is more efficient, is more therefore more affordable. And part of the problem in New Hampshire, and it's unique to New Hampshire with respect to our market structure, is that PSNH is still a vertically integrated utility. So PSNH is the only utility in New England that not only distributes and sells electricity, but generates its own electricity. And so the inefficiencies that we're experiencing, for example, with the coal power plants, PSNH has not been fully exposed to the market because they're essentially subsidized by ratepayers.
Wow.
And that's what the PUC staff were getting to in that report.
A whole show just from your question, Wade. Real interesting on the business model. Thank you for calling. And we'll take more of your calls after a short break, so stay right here.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning.
On the next Diane Rain Show, partisan rancor in the Senate and the future of the filibuster, then why college is so expensive. All coming up on the Diane Rain Show.
The Diane Rain Show this morning from 10 till noon on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our members, and support also comes to us from North Branch Construction, 54 years experience building custom homes to multi-million-dollar eco-friendly commercial buildings on time, on budget, online at Facebook, LinkedIn, and northbranch.net. And from New Hampshire Hospital for Children, now offering pediatric neurology, gastroenterology, nephrology, pulmonary medicine, and integrative medicine. NHHospitalForChildren.org. It is 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow in The Exchange, uncertainty over immigration reform as a U.S. Senate pass bill stalls in the U.S. House. Email us your questions before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, we're getting a regional take on President Obama's new climate change plan, especially its focus on reducing carbon emissions from power plants. We're looking at the impact on New Hampshire and on the region. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. 1-800-892-6477. Now that you've heard a little bit about this plan, what do you think? Do you think it's taking the right approach? Do you see any problems with this plan? Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. And let's take another call. This is from Concord. James is on the air. Hi, James. Go ahead. Thanks for waiting.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of points here. I think we do need to have a balance with the macro and micro here. We need to look at the larger institutions, but we also need to look at the individuals. And I think with that, we need education and incentive. If you look at the trash and recycling program in Concord, you know, a lot of people were not recycling until they were forced to pay for trash bags and had to do it. So I think there needs to be some incentive there to get people to do it. Otherwise, they won't. Also, my last point is I find it kind of ironic. I see NHPR as a leader in this area, but I hear over the commercial break that, you know, I think it's a raffle. They're giving away $2,000 in gas, and I think that's kind of ironic there.
Right.
That they're choosing gas to give away as a gift. Could there be something else to lead the way here? And I'll take my responses off the air.
Well, and James, let me ask you real quick. So
sure.
Education and incentive. So are you saying that this this approach that the president's taking doesn't look enough at personal responsibility, hitting the power plants too hard? Is that what you're saying? Or just should be more inclusive?
Not necessarily what the president is doing, but I think within the state, I think the smart meter is a great option that one of the gentlemen was talking about to educate individuals on their use and their consequences of their use.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling in, James. Appreciate it. And, Kurt, we touched on this before when we talked about what about cars and cutting emissions from cars, and you said yes, but 40% of carbon emissions do come from power plants. What do you think about James' point, though? You know, let's get everybody on board here.
Oh, I think that's a great point. I really do. And, you know, while the Clean Air Act allows us to look at power plants, and we have a three-year program to put in place. I should share the dates with people in a moment. But looking at the transportation sector is very important, and the president and the program has raised those efficiency standards significantly over the last, in the first term. In fact, I saw a commentary written in Time magazine which talked about all the things that have happened in the first term. And indeed, we've made real progress on how to make the whole transportation sector more efficient. It can become even more efficient. And I'll tell you what's happening. It's very exciting to me is the states are working together on electric vehicles. We've got recharging stations being sited all over New England, hundreds across New England. This is an opportunity. In fact, if you bought an electric vehicle today and you went to your mall that has just put in a power station, they're not charging you for that energy. Literally, someone could probably buy an electric vehicle, 100 to 100, 200-mile vehicle, and charge it all over the community that they live in and probably not have to pay a dime for their energy right now. So the bottom line is there's a lot the individual can do in terms of choices, smart meters, cars, what kind of light bulbs, LED light bulbs, what kind of appliances. The Energy Star is only going to get more. We're going to raise those numbers on Energy Star. It's going to be comprehensive as we go forward. And essentially, the president is all in. We're going to use all the tools we know to try to reduce the carbon footprint of America.
I want to get back to coal that we started out talking about. And again, the concern that this plan especially is difficult for coal utilities. And Martin Murray, to you, are there ways to work more cleanly with coal? I mean, you know, some people are saying just get rid of it. It's too problematic. It's too dirty. What do you think, Martin? Is there a way to make coal greener and cleaner?
Well, when you burn gas or you burn coal, you are releasing carbon that would otherwise not be released. There is nothing on the shelf at Home Depot or anywhere that I can go and buy and put a box on Merrimack Station to reduce carbon. With today's technology, so far, basically it's running less, producing less carbon. That's the same for gas as well. And gas does produce less carbon, but it produces by far most of the carbon in the region. But Kurt may be able to speak to this, actually. There are people, scientists and others, that are working somewhere on blackboards and computers to figure out a way, can we sequester carbon?
Sequester means capture it and put it away,
right,
so it doesn't get out.
Or can we reduce it in some other fashion? As I said, there's no magic box that we can buy today that allows us to do that. But people are working on that, and I think people are hopeful that we would have that sort of solution. If we could produce that fuel, the energy from that particular fuel, much cleaner, it would be terrific, because we're basically kind of the Saudi Arabia of coal.
Right. America has a lot of it.
Absolutely.
So there is no quote-unquote clean coal, Martin? I mean, President Obama used to talk about that.
Correct.
When he ran for office.
We buy a certain coal that has a lower sulfur content than others, but there really isn't a lower carbon content than others.
Tom, what do you think? Move away from coal, it's the fuel of the last century, or are there ways to work with coal more efficiently, more cleanly?
It really is the fuel of the last century. You know, carbon capture and sequestration, there's still many questions around that technology. It will cost a lot to develop that technology. It relies on underground geologic formations to store carbon, and there are questions about leakage. In New England, we don't really have a place for sequestration. So there are significant problems. And I think it's also important with coal, as with any fuel source, to look at the full life cycle impact. And when you take into account the impacts associated with mining coal.
Getting it out of the ground.
Well, not just getting it out of the ground, but mountaintop removal, where they are literally leveling mountains, you know, in Appalachia. There are water impacts, health impacts, you name it. It's a major problem, and it really does not have a role in a future clean energy economy.
Well, so here's the question then for you, Tom, and I asked Kurt Spalding about this earlier. Again, you know, people talk about alternatives replacing coal, but you know, here in New Hampshire, boy, wind projects have faced major opposition and some have been canceled. We've done millions of shows on Northern Pass and that hydro project that has tried to get through. Biomass has been controversial. So, you know, people may say, yeah, I agree with you on coal, but it's been tough for alternative energy projects recently here in New Hampshire.
It has.
So what replaces it?
Well, first of all, I think you need to recognize that ISO New England, the entity that runs New England's electricity grid, ISO New England knows that coal is exiting the market. There is not a great panic at ISO New England at that fact. There is, you know, we have more supply right now than we need. We're making progress on energy efficiency. We need to continue that progress and really, you know, make that a much steeper curve in terms of the amount of energy savings we can accomplish. But absolutely, renewables need to be a part of the picture. You know, we consider that Canadian hydro will play a role for this region. We have significant concerns with Northern Pass. We don't believe at this time that Northern Pass is the solution. There's another project to the east of us, the Northeast Energy Link, that would bring Canadian hydro down from Maine. And that project, very significantly, will not only be transmitting hydropower, but also wind-generated power from northern Maine. So it's important to, you know, if we're going to look at Canadian hydro, for example, we need to see, we need to plan for it. We need to make sure it makes sense for our long-term energy future. And we need to make sure that those transmission projects have other significant benefits, such as providing opportunities for true renewables like wind. And I think it's important to note that in most, really with the exception of Connecticut, large-scale Canadian hydro, because of the impacts associated with it, and there are climate impacts associated with it, is not considered a renewable form of energy.
It just seems sometimes as if everybody says, yay, green energy, but then when the project ends up in their backyard, they say, nah, we don't like that. And sometimes the opposition comes from environmental groups like yours. So it's a trade-off there.
I would say, you know, Tom said there's not a great panic on the part of the regulators in New England, but, you know, I'm paraphrasing them, Tom, but ISO spoke loud and clear about the danger New England was in this past February when we basically almost ran out of electricity. And the reason for that is there's so much demand now for gas. We are just so over-reliant on gas. We use it for home heating, and we're building more of that, and we're using it more and more. More than half of our electricity in the region now comes from natural gas. The large majority of carbon comes from natural gas. But they spoke loud and clear. There's a real concern that we are too dependent on this. So we do need other forms of energy. We need the diverse portfolio we have now, including the limited use of coal. We need projects like Northern Pass. We need other hydro projects if we can get that. We need a whole portfolio of answers to this very, very serious question.
Let's take one more call if we could, gentlemen. And this is Roger joining us in Stratham. Hi, Roger. Thanks for waiting. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Terrific program. One element of the president's climate plan has to do with adaptation. I'm a member of the Coastal Adaptation Work Group. This past legislative session, the Coastal Hazards and Sea Level Rise Commission was passed in bipartisan form by the state legislature, understanding that the best planning for the impact of climate change in the coast has to be done locally, but local people need federal tools to protect their communities. We've already bitten off a chunk of carbon dioxide that will impact the coast and the rest of New Hampshire, so I'd like the guests comment on that, please.
Well, and Roger, thanks for the call. And Kurt Spalding, again, regional administrator for EPA in New England. He's right. The plan, we've been focusing on the power plants, but the plan does include money for communities like Roger's to adapt to the impact of climate change.
The caller said it better than I could, quite honestly. The preparedness issue is perhaps the most problematic in this whole conversation because in our case, 50% of the people in New England live in these coastal areas. I mean, New England, for all its size, is really a place where people are very close to the coast. So we need to do all we can as quickly as we can to prepare for what the inevitable impacts of climate change will be. Now, we've been working on this for a couple of years. I have a team here in the region who's working with communities. We've done something called climate-ready estuaries, looking at not only the rise, but also look at the size of storm drains and what's going to happen when you have flooding events. So we have a comprehensive approach. It needs more behind it. And I lament the fact that Congress is not addressing climate change, indeed, because they are the appropriators in the end of the day. They are the people who create the funding for addressing these kinds of problems. So somehow that problem in D.C. has to be addressed, because I think in the end we're talking about a very large national problem. Communities everywhere are going to be dealing with this, and there's going to need to be funding to address it. And a lot of it is about infrastructure and what you're going to protect and what you're not. We're paying very close attention to what's going on in New York City right now, post-Sandy, and how Mayor Bloomberg has set this issue up. We're going to do a lot of things over the next 6 months in the region, working with leaders on trying to get this preparedness issue really teed up and get the needs really well defined beyond the mapping part. But we also need to do more. More is what really is going to have to happen. And I think the caller is right on. The next couple of decades, it's going to be an enormous challenge, and we just have to really start talking about it in a very open, plain way. And what I think is really exciting is we have a lot of mayors in New England, and New Hampshire's no exception, who are really standing up and saying to everyone, the political leaders above them, enough of this partisan stuff. We have real problems associated with climate change, and we're going to need your help to solve it, and we just have to channel that voice and get it moving. This plan validates that. We're going to do all we can. At the same time, we're cutting budgets. So we have to figure out how to serve our communities in the context of a fairly challenging situation at the federal level.
Well, and I'm glad you made the point that, again, this is being done by executive order, not through a bill in Congress, because it is politically difficult. So that's good to get that in there. Tom, you want to jump in?
Just quickly, on the issue of adaptation, it's critical. It's a very important part of the plan. I would add to everything that Kurt said with respect to better infrastructure and planning that there's a real public health component to climate change. As basic as more people dying during severe heat events. So, you know, that needs to be part of the planning as well. How we help people who themselves may not have the resources, may not have air conditioning, for example, to deal with severe heat events and literally avoid death. So cooling centers, for example, are ways to do that. But it's a very complicated issue. We need to deal with the infrastructure. We need to deal with public health.
Yeah, and Martin, to you, there's a long time frame for this. The rules are supposed to be developed over the next couple of years, put in place by mid-2016. What do you hope happens between now and then?
Well, honestly, I hope that our Northern Pass project moves forward in terms of the next couple of years. You know, that we haven't talked about that, but that plan can reduce CO2 emissions in New England by up to 5 million tons per year. That's like taking almost a million cars off the road over the course of a year. And I'm gratified to hear that Tom's group supports the idea of large hydro from Canada as being part of the solution if we do it right. So that's where we're going to be focused our energy on in terms of what are you doing to reduce carbon. That's a big part of our answer.
Tom, go ahead.
Just very quickly on the carbon point as it relates to Northern Pass, we have seen no analysis to support the claim that 5 million tons of carbon emissions will be avoided by Northern Pass.
And studies on the web, so I'll share it with Tom.
Okay,
well,
maybe
it's based on an assumption that hydro is zero carbon, and that is not the case.
I sense another show.
We've done bazillion shows on Northern Pass, and it sounds like there is another one in the works. Kurt Spalding, a quick last thoughts from you, please.
Yeah, I think what's really important, you mentioned the 3 years ahead and how this architecture of a program needs to be built. We're going to need a lot of participation. One of the principles the president's bringing to this is a collaborative approach with our states and our communities. So over the next year, we're going to be asking people to come and participate in how we can put together a flexible program that has common sense elements to it, that emphasizes what we can do, that not only reduces the carbon emissions, but also increases our economic vitality.
Okay.
So we're going to need people to participate in the process as we go forward. This is a very strong, aggressive schedule. But as we know, only through participation will we get the best ideas out of all parts of our community. And Josh knows New England is a place where people are innovating and thinking about this in serious, thoughtful ways. We're not in a place where everyone's having fights about this. We're in a place where people want to move forward.
All right,
so
Kurt, I got to cut you off there. Yeah, I appreciate it. And thank you so much for joining us this hour.
Thank you, Laura.
Kurt Spalding, Administrator for EPA's New England region. Martin Murray, Tom Irwin, thank you also for being here. Really appreciate it. Pleasure. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Tim Camerato. A volunteer is Alan Cohen. The executive producer is Keith Shields. And I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, uncertainty over immigration reform. The Senate has passed a significant overhaul of the country's immigration laws. The plan includes a path to citizenship and more border security. But the bipartisan effort has stalled at the House border, with some Republicans there calling the bill dead on arrival. We'll talk with Granite Staters following this debate. Email us at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
The Diane Rehm Show next at 10.